understand that.
Okay, the.
Well, no one I believe for a mental health crisis.
Absolutely.
First thing I'm going to say is that my task is to try to convince you, and your task is to show me the flaws in the argument that I'm going to be presenting. It's a rather different perspective on stellar convection than you are used to seeing. And as a consequence, I'm having some difficulties in trying to formulate things really cleanly and precisely, because since mixing link theory was invented by Erica Boom Vitense in the 1950s, it has seeped into our brains so that we don't think about convection as other scientists might. It's colored by the mixing link theory. So there are all sorts of implicit assumptions that we have. I will just start out with this. There are some key differences in what I'm going to discuss in the mixing link theory. For example, the mixing link theory has no error estimates. You know, we say that it works whenever we can adjust parameters so that we fit star, but we don't have internal consistency within the mixing link theory. And there are a number of different aspects of that. The work that I'm going to discuss allows us to estimate the coefficient of the Kolmogorov-Forkos law. The Forkos law is the turbulent dissipation rate for uniform turbulence with no boundaries. And Forkos, of course, is 0.8. We do it numerically, we get 0.85. So that gives you an idea of the level of the accuracy that we can expect by doing things from the techniques that I'm going to show you.
Which is correct, 0.8 or 0.85?
Well, in fact, that is a very interesting point, because 0.80 is correct if you have no boundaries and you have a homogeneous system. We don't. And the correction's the order of 5%. So.
And that's coming from 3D modeling?
That's from 3D modeling.
That can't be measured?
It probably could, but this is new stuff. We haven't explored all the possibilities.
Kolmogorov is new stuff.
The 0.85 is the 0.80 is very old.
Yeah.
And can you do experimental work at the 5% level in turbulent flow? I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that.
I maybe I'm completely off here, but is there like you have to go in Kolmogorov to very small scales, right?
Yes.
So the there is a numerical problem there because
I will discuss this in detail. That's coming up, and thank you for highlighting that point.
That's the slope in the inertial range.
Right.
So it shouldn't be dependent.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And in fact, that's probably not what it is. It's probably the boundaries.
Right. So yeah. Injection scale.
Because the boundaries are not homogeneous. Right.
By definition.
Yeah. There's no kinetic energy flux.
That's your first point.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
No kinetic energy or acoustic fluxes. No deceleration at the boundaries, whereas we should actually be using the Richardson criteria for mixing. We ought to have buoyancy breaking and the alpha overshoot function.
Can you define the Richardson criteria?
I'll show it in a moment.
Good.
And finally, mixing link theory is static, whereas in fact we know in the simplest case of a model of convection, the Lorentz role, that there is deterministic chaos. And we'll see this again. Okay, the first step is to generate some data. Okay, what do we do? Well, first place, we take oxygen burning. We stumbled on this, but in fact, oxygen burning is the optimum case to use because it relaxes thermally so fast that we can do many thermal relaxation times. And we haven't done one for the solar convection zone yet. We ignore rotation and magnetic fields. We can't afford to put them in. I mean, we could put them in, but we couldn't afford to calculate them with resolution so that we really get hurt. We don't do a whole star, we just do a sector again. We stretch, we do the absolute minimum, most efficient sort of calculation that we can so that we will really get turbulence. We use implicit large eddy simulations, which allow us to not resolve the Kolmogorov spectrum. So we're really very lucky there. We only have to do the big stuff because that's where the action is. And we only get a range of Reynolds numbers because we've only got a certain size computer and computer budget.
But these are not the Reynolds numbers that have been stars.
These are the, oh, now there is a wonderful question. Actually, these are, I would argue, the correct Reynolds numbers because in turbulence, it's a nonlinear process, it renormalizes the effective dissipation. And in fact, if you use renormalization theory, you end up with numbers rather like we find numerically. So there's something, I think there's something deep here. However,
so what is the smallest Prandtl number you get?
The Prandtl number tends to be the order of the unit. And it's not determined by the microphysics, it's determined by the macrophysics.
You know, it's Prandtl number in stars.
I think the Prandtl number in stars is the same as the. Yeah, because they're
trying to. Prandtl number in the sun is 10 to the minus 6.
Yes. Yes, but that's a microscopic Prandtl.
But that's how the dissipation takes place.
Yeah.
That's how the dissipation takes place. And it can be shown if you use, for instance, large eddy simulations.
Yeah.
Depending on what subgrid models you use, you get different results.
Yeah.
That is true. And all I can do is use the one thing that we can calculate. These are solutions to Navier-Stokes equations. I will use general properties, but there are issues. And I'm not convinced that, in fact, in the turbulent case, we're not capturing the right physics. But I can't prove it.
But just to make sure, if you have a Prandtl number of 1, then this is the Prandtl number of the air in this room, which is 0.7 approximately.
Yes.
And that's rather different, again, to what's really happening in stars.
That is at the microscopic level, but not at the macroscopic level, as I will argue. Let me make the argument.
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Now, the approach that we're going to take is we have something we can calculate. It is a solution of the Navier-Stokes equations. And it is turbulent. It may bias our final results. We don't know. But this is better than what we're doing now. A lot better. Okay, why do we think that the physics works out properly? It's because at the grid scale for a certain class of hydrodynamic calculations. In fact, they're called monotonicity preserving methods. You reproduce conservation, not as an oscillating way, but in a constant way. Basically, you're paying attention to discontinuities so that you conserve mass, momentum, and energy on the grid scale. That gives you a scaling that is the same scaling that Kolmogorov derived for homogeneous turbulence. And we find in practice a certain bit of magic happens that the coefficient out front tends to be the same. I think there's something deep here. I've not quite figured out how to explicitly show why this turns out, but empirically, this is a fact. Okay, let's calculate some stuff. This is the bottom boundary in an oxygen-burning shell. There are two things I want you to get take away. One is there's an overall flow, and you can see material coming off through this top surface. The actual computation volume goes on much further. And you'll also see there's a lot of small swirly stuff. So there are basically two important components. This is one of the reasons that treating convection and turbulence in stars is so nasty, is because it has these two different phases, a very large scale and a very small scale. If this is a simulation by Nordlund and Stein, you look at a greater depth, you will notice that there are some bits of material that go down. In fact, they go down through the whole of the convection zone. So that if you use a diffusion model for convection, you're ignoring that an important component is in fact advective in large-scale flow. If you ask the question, how would you split up the part of the velocity field, the kinetic energy in the small-scale flow and the large-scale flow, then in the largest eddies, you have about half of the energy, and then all the rest, you have the other half. So you can't do one or the other. They're both important. Also, if you actually do a 3D calculation, you get coupling between the convective properties and the pulsation. This is it. Okay, now let's take off our numerical experimentalist hat and start doing some theory. First thing, we do a Reynolds decomposition of the variables to get rid of the fluctuations, to see if there's something robust underlying that, and it turns out there certainly is. We do averages over turnover times. In fact, explicitly, we'll do four transit times as our averaging time. And we decompose, project our three-dimensional theta and phi over spherical surface down to simply a radial coordinate so that we can make contact with stellar evolution ghosts.
So you assume here statistically steady turbulence? You assume here statistically steady turbulence?
No.
Why do you then average more time?
We simply look at the results.
Well, averaging should be done on some level.
We simply look at the results, and the empirical results is that they are steady for these models. Okay?
Does it matter what order you do the averaging?
It does not matter which way we do the averaging, and it doesn't matter very much exactly what the domain for the time is. We get basically the same result. It's robust with regard to resolution. And it's robust with regard to changing the computational dimension, which we've scaled up by a factor of 8 in linear dimension. So, and we explicitly follow the acoustic and turbulent energy. We're doing a direct calculation, so we have all the data, so we just look at them. And in the first simulation I showed you, what we find is there is, in fact, something very robust underlying what we're seeing. Let me tell you what it is. If we dot the velocity fluctuation with the Navier-Stokes equation, we have the rate at which kinetic energy is being produced. That's this equation. Rate of change of kinetic energy, volumetric kinetic energy is equal to divergence of kinetic energy flux, divergence of an acoustic flux, the work done, but the pressure fluctuations on the compression fluctuation, the buoyancy, and the damping. And I give you the numbers in appropriate units for this particular simulation. And you'll see that, in fact, there are two dominant terms, which tend to cancel. Chandrasekhar knew this. He proved it for laminar flows in great and gory detail in his big book. These are not exactly equal. The next term is, in fact, the divergence of the kinetic energy. There's a very simple explanation of that. The driving is produced by the buoyancy, which is localized. The damping is at the small scale, and that's not localized. So how does that work out physically? You have a divergence of kinetic energy flux. So wherever you put in the turbulence, it spreads out to give you the total amount of damping. Like the situation in the interior among stars, the flow is strongly subsonic. It's only in the slivers of material very near the surface of stars where the temperature really drops. That sound speed's got low enough that you have to worry about effects of compressibility. Our simulations assume compressibility, so we'd be happy with shocks form and all the rest of it, but they just don't.
So are these numbers dependent? You try that on the resolution of your simulation, like, for example, the scale of the dissipation?
We have redone with a factor to better resolution, linear change, so it's factor of eight in actual number of zones. And half as many zones, we get the same answers to within about 10%. And the big change is when we go to lower resolution where it's not so turbulent, so the approximation, the theoretical model doesn't make quite so much sense. Now, the black line here is the actual numerical dissipation over the convection zone. The colored line is what Kolmogorov would predict, and I've not adjusted the height. That height is the 0.8 and the 0.85 we discussed earlier. It breaks down near the boundaries, but Kolmogorov derives his damping form with the assumption that he has isotropy, and that's not true at the boundaries. What is happening in the boundaries, in fact, is that you're developing an acoustical wave flux so that the convective motion is stimulating pressure fluctuations, which don't affect the kinetic energy very much, but turn around the flow. And the higher pressure causes the boundary to move, and that gives a coupling between the kinetic energy and acoustical wave flux. And then, because of an impedance mismatch, it's not very large for this simulation outside the convective region. Okay, I've already said that. This is not a steady state process by any stretch of the imagination. Think about it. We are accelerating things on very large scales. We're damping them on the very smallest scales. Those are not very well coupled. It takes time for them to talk to each other. That means that if you get a burst of buoyancy, it overshoots the stable point, the balance point. And then later, as that filters down to the damping scales, you've overshot the damping, so it turns itself off. So you get these pulses in kinetic energy as a function of time, which are basically large scale modes. And the fluctuations are the order, same order as the steady state average. Okay? The Lorentz model, let me remind you, was an elegantly simple mathematical version of a convective roll. It's only two-dimensional. And it was solved by Edward Lorentz on one of the first personal computers of a sort, departmental computers, really, back in the 60s. So he made this as simple as he possibly could, but no simpler, as Einstein supposedly said. And it's different from mixing length. It has three variables. Mixing length basically has two. You have a velocity, and you have a temperature gradient. But in the Lorentz model, the temperature gradient is either horizontal or vertical. So there are two different variables. So we have a three-variable system. We can write down amplitude equations for this and solve them. We could also imagine populating a convective region with various convective rolls. The Lorentz equations have characteristic nonlinearity. So if you tried to put this in an adiabatic pulsation, or not adiabatic pulsation code, you wouldn't see what's in fact the origin of the phenomenon, because it's quadratic here. What these terms are, x is the rate at which, the speed at which it's going around the circle. Y is the horizontal temperature difference, and Z is the vertical temperature difference. And these two terms are the advection terms. So they have an X times a temperature difference, and X times the other temperature difference. So that's where the chaotic behavior comes from. Okay, I've already said that. That's an example of the sort of thing that you get. One of the characteristics of the chaotic behavior is that you have multiple solutions, and the nonlinearity allows the solution space to communicate between the different realms. In this particular case, it's really very simple, since the thing is turning. It could either be clockwise or counterclockwise. And what happens is that it goes back and forth. Here, X. It's positive over here, that means it's going one way, say clockwise. Then negative X is going opposite, which is counterclockwise. And it keeps flipping back and forth. If we go back to our 3D simulation and we plot up the kinetic energy as a function of time, this is a simply one-dimensional version of the two-dimensional color plot with the bursts in it. You see that there are these bursts. If we look at the Lorentz model and we start it up in the same way, we get pulses like that. This is much cleaner. The Lorentz model only has one mode. So the number of degrees of freedom here, you know, X, Y, and Z, let's call it three, this corresponds to about something of the order of several times 10 to the 8. So there's an enormous reduction in the number of degrees of freedom in these two models, but there's a similarity. You know, you see these roles going on in the same place. Okay, well, let's play a game with this. Can we do anything that might be interesting astronomically? Schwarzschild in the 70s proposed that Betelgeuse had a relatively had a structure which had relatively few pressure scale heights, and he thought that maybe there would only be a couple of convective cells. In fact, he chose a dozen. So we use a dozen cells, which we assume are incoherent, and then we look at the luminosity fluctuation. Because the Lorentz model has luminosity fluctuations as well as velocity fluctuations. Meteorologists were not particularly interested in that, but as astronomers we are. And you get something that looks like this.
Except from temperature? fluctuation?
This is the flux fluctuation. And it's, so it's the combination of the temperature and the velocity.
Because the flux is...
If you bring hot stuff up quickly, it's high. If you don't, it's low. If you, an observational comment, Joel Stebbins started, was inventing photoelectric photometry. And Betelgeuse, brightest star, is a good one to look at. It's strong in the infrared, which his detector could pick up. And he tried to analyze it in terms of some sort of harmonic oscillator. His comment was, in the variations of the light from Betelgeuse, there is no rhyme nor reason. That was after two decades of work. That's the strange attractor. If you look at the power spectrum, over about a factor of 10 in frequency, it's fairly flat. So this is going to give a broadband source to luminosity fluctuations in stars. Okay. Now, could we fix mixing link theory? Well, we can fix it at various levels. But it's important to know what we're fixing. Mixing length theory says basically the kinetic energy is proportional to the potential energy that you get from the adiabatic fluctuation in the convection zone. So you integrate the buoyancy over some mixing length to get this relationship, and you get this factor of eight because of various assumptions about. You assume it starts out with no velocity and it accelerates up to a maximum velocity linearly so that the average is a half. And then you also have a half coming in because you've got a temperature gradient. So that this coefficient is sort of uncertain. However, if you note that you can integrate over the buoyancy force over the convection zone, then the flux terms go to zero, or at least they're small, the 1% level and the numbers I showed. And you can simply relate that to the Kolmogorov damping, where this is the damping length, which is basically 4/5 of the dimension of the convection zone. Now, if we're in the low Mach number limit, then the density fluctuation and the temperature fluctuations are linked, because the low Mach number limit means that the pressure fluctuations are small. So if you've changed the temperature, it's reflected in the corresponding change in the density, which means that this thing can be constructed from the convective luminosity, which is what we have in stellar evolution model. And we can get a velocity scale, which judging from the numerical simulations that I've been able to check this on, and just from the internal logic of the mathematics, I'd suspect we're talking about things the order of 10% accuracy. And that's a lot better than with mixing. So we can get the velocity scale. Now let me, that's all for the prepared talk. And now I'm getting to the point where I like to throw the floor open to questions. But let me make one last point. This is taking the two largest terms and ignoring the rest. We can get more out of the turbulent kinetic energy equation. If you take it seriously, then what it tells you is that you get buoyancy breaking at the boundaries, and it tells you what that condition is. And that condition turns out to be the Richardson number. you see better over, which side would you like me to write it on?
I think if we flip the lights on.
Yeah, let's.
Switch back behind that black.
Must be a race difference.
Which is just equal to the Ledoux criteria times gravity times pressure scale height over velocity squared. Now, we have used the Schwarzschild criteria in stellar astronomy for a long time historically, instead of the Ledoux criteria, because the Ledoux criteria is more restrictive, so you've got smaller cores, and the cores are bigger. So we throw it out. But in fact, it was right. If you have a composition gradient, then we should be using the Ledoux criteria. However, the condition is not that that goes to zero, but rather that it's not too big. And if it's not too big, it means that you've got enough kinetic energy to balance the fact that you have a stable stratification. Now, if you go out and talk to someone that actually knows something about erosion, they will immediately tell you erosion depends on the composition of what's being eroded and on the velocity with which you're trying to erode it. This gives that. Okay, so that's an important bit of physics, which falls out of, let me go back and show you the original equation.
Where do you get the V from? That is just going to ask the same question. Okay. Like we're in a hypothetically a stable region.
Yeah, so on one side you've got the V, and on the other side it's unstable. So what you're, the question that you're asking is,
which V is
the, I thought we were trying to determine V from the physics, but it seems like
no, V is property of the whole convection zone. So you integrate over the whole. Imagine doing successive approximations, two big terms. Get a first cut approximation of V simply by looking at the total buoyancy and.
This is the vertical component. This is the vertical component of your velocity.
It's a vertical component of the large scale velocity field. It's not the vertical component of the small scale velocity field.
It's not the V what you showed in the previous view.
This V is essentially the same V. It is the large component which is most effective at eroding the boundaries. We could talk about that in more detail. I made the statement of my interpretation of the numerics, but I haven't really driven that down to the point where I'm 100% sure. But it looks like the predominant thing is the large scale motion, which is the larger. That's about half of the, that gives slightly larger velocities and there's less material so that the kinetic energies are equal. And the larger velocity, I think, but I'm getting into subtleties now.
Unlike mixing lengths, I'm no longer calculating V locally.
Right.
This is now a global from the
right.
Zone V.
Right. And the precise algorithm, I'm not sure what would be the best thing, but you can do a successive approximation. These two give you an estimate for V. Okay? And that's the V that you're interested in. You can say, oh, but I told you there were two different V's, they're the same order. So if we know they're the same order, then these two give us the estimate for both of them. Again, quick and dirty, but still much more accurate than mixing length. Now, there are other terms. We can then, with this partial solution, estimate what these corrections are. So that gives us a closed system for solution. This part, you see, if you get near a boundary, then this thing can actually change sign. Now that gets very embarrassing in mixing one, because you say the velocity squared is equal to that thing. And when it changes sign, then you have an imaginary velocity, which is not good. So people avoid that, but you don't have to solve it, because we say it's the Schwarzschild criteria, and that's why we have to use the Schwarzschild criteria, which sets the velocity to zero exactly when that changes sign. In this case, what does it do? Well, it does something that the Boulder people knew about over 10 years ago when they were doing some of their first simulations. They noticed at the edge of the convection zone. In fact, this would change sign, so instead of accelerating the velocity field, it's decelerating the velocity field. And if it decelerates the velocity field, this guy is this guy. That is, this thing is essentially that for the low Mach number flow. So we're led to the conclusion that if we want the solution for the turbulent energy to go to zero, then this changes sign in just such a way that we have the Reynolds number. Now let me get back to the point of where we're doing this. This is an integral over the whole convection zone, so it's positive. Even though near the edge, we can have deceleration. This, however, we now look at what I call the external region, the radiatedly stable region. So what the picture is, you have these motions, and they're impacting a stable zone. And whether or not they can cause mixing depends on how stable that zone is. Do you have enough kinetic energy to overcome the potential energy in the stable region? So this is in the convection region, this is in the stable. So it's conditioned on the boundary. Now we don't usually have conditions on the boundary because the mixing length, as Ed Spiegel pointed out it many, many years ago, mixing length throws out derivatives. We have these derivatives, and that's what they tell us. Okay, more questions?
Just a practical question. Does this formulation, is there a chance that it would address the deficiencies in mixing length that are responsible for the surface index?
We don't know the answer till we do it. It certainly has a good chance of doing it, because it's including more physics.
So it captures more of the relevant physics.
Yeah, remember, this is based on solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation. So we really do have those solutions. Now, they may not be the right solutions that we want for stars. These are the ones that we can get. So I'm not proud, let's just go with these solutions and see what the implications are.
And there is a formulation for implementing this sort of description into a 1D stellar model. That was going to be my question.
Yeah, people did it already.
Hi, Bill. That's why I'm here.
We'll try.
We know the density, temperature, composition, gradient, and the adiabatic gradient. Is that enough?
Yeah.
Basically.
But you do need to calculate V.
Right.
Yes.
So we don't, but how do you know that?
Okay.
Because that's all the models.
Right here. Models produce. Integrate this over the convection zone. You've got the convective luminosity. The convective luminosity tells you what the V has to be.
So it seems like we're kind of assuming a rather homogeneous convection zone. If we're saying everything contributes equally.
Well, wait. You're assuming that turbulence tries to mix things uniformly.
Yeah, but I mean the point about the surface of a convective envelope is that things are very, very
different in the outer part of the convective envelope than they are in the rest of it. That's why surface effects are such a problem. So I wouldn't have thought treating the whole thing as homogeneous is going to work that well.
Okay, here is boundary. Here's another one. Both of these are stable regions. What happens in the simulations is that the boundary is not static, it's dynamic. Okay, where do you put in a dynamic boundary mixing point here? But that's important physics, because what happens is it flexes up and down and it drives G-mode waves, both the top and the bottom. The luminosity is actually comparable. Down here, the amplitudes are smaller, but then this is much denser.
But what's the density or pressure scale height in this?
There are two. Two. Yes.
In your equation, we're just number over there. The only thing that is global is the v squared. Everything else is local.
Right.
So there is no homogeneity assumption concerning anything except the fact that there is a v squared that you're getting from the fact that you're getting major, the big cell roll.
Yeah, and
everything else
physically,
is local.
Yeah, physically this turns out, because the acceleration is a partial with respect to time, times the velocity times the gradient. And that's nonlinearity is what's
I can make my question more precise.
Yeah.
When you do the integral over the whole convection zone,
right,
are you taking an integral in like Eulerian coordinates or in mass coordinates? Because the two will give you massively different answers.
In this case, they did not. So we need to tell me about them.
Okay. That was my question, really.
Yeah.
How do you interpret the average over the whole volume? Is it literally a volume average or is it a mass average?
It's a very explicit.
See, I thought I had that.
Interesting.
Because you'll probably get a difference of a factor of 100.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So it's probably important. Yeah. Right.
No, it's there's not a choice.
Well, the velocity.
I don't have a choice. I can only do it one way. Okay, it's prescribed.
Is that because the cells are so?
Here, let me write it out.
The convection looks so different in the other 1% of the sun than it does in the rest of the convection zone.
Yeah, but the question is whether if you look at the largest cell, whether that vertical velocity is changing dramatically as you get near the, well, obviously it's turning over. Yeah, who knows? Like Dave says, it can't be much worse than what we're doing now.
This is an implicit interval. Just make you a little bit more. So if I got the factors right. You have to iterate. You put in a guess. And this thing, averaged, turns out to be this thing.
Averaged by bands or something.
Right, right. So it's an implicit equation. But if, you know, computer solved that really nicely. That's not much of an issue. It's not a very nasty implicit equation. So this is the acceleration, and this is the velocity perturbation. So their product is, in fact, the rate at which you're pumping per unit mass. You're pumping energy into the turbulent cascade, so we integrate over mass. So, you know, it's not some arbitrary thing. I don't really have any choice at all here. That comes directly from the turbulent energy.
How does that translate to the convective core? Because your simulations assume two stable boundary conditions,
right,
up and bottom, mm-hmm, and in your core, you don't have a second boundary.
We've done it for the cores too, and that's what's about the same. The cores, you tend to, you have this additional dipole tendency, because you can get fluid flowing through the center of the star.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It does. If the code will allow it, it does. That's one of the problems. Some of the hydro codes put a boundary condition in at the center, and they forget to allow for that to happen.
But all things translate to the 1 D.
But also when you have to contact before, sometimes the pressure scale height is small, it's larger than the pore size.
Yeah.
And then your simulations would not work.
No. No, we don't assume. See, this is one of those implicit assumptions. No, and we don't actually use the pressure scale height physically.
Yes, because you have several.
This has a pressure scale height built into it. This is here because of the way these things are defined. Yeah. I could perfectly well define this as an entropy gradient over a radial distance.
Yes, but when you...
And there's no pressure scale height at all.
When you calculate your average velocity, you have to assume that there are several eddies, big eddies.
No.
No?
No, that's the point. Let's look at the blue. Yeah, we need to have the lights down now. You see, there's a component, which is about half of the flow. So if you just, quick and dirty, say, okay, half of the flow is this big component, then that goes all the way down.
So exactly on this movie, which I think is very interesting, one question, I guess, would be, which is very interesting, and I'm kind of convinced this is the direction to go, but I want to repropose what Inter was saying before, that basically here, if you imagine going to, you know, different aerodynamic numbers, in particular different Prandtl number, and increasing resolution of your simulation, would you expect to have the same advective component in the same?
I don't know the answer to that.
Because, you know, my experience tells that if you even try to change this number in the parameter space that you can access, which is very tiny compared to the distance you want to get.
Well, certainly in the Lorentz model, if you change the Prandtl number, you get very different results.
Right. My expectation would be that this plumes will break down much earlier. Much more turbulence will lead to dissipation.
Well, actually, I think that it goes the other way. I think when you go to the larger scales, it's harder for the material to know about the smaller scales. And you're starting with a large scale stratification. So it's a macroscopic thing that we're dealing with. That is the acceleration that we're putting in really is big scale. It's not microscopic.
Okay, but usually what I see is that if you increase the Prandtl number, or to smaller Prandtl number, usually all this structure become much more unstable and they tend to leave.
Well, if you look at Rayleigh-Taylor plumes. If you look at Rayleigh-Taylor plumes and you go to higher Reynolds numbers, you still preserve the overall large scale. I mean, you get much more filigree. Mm-hmm. So the small component is definitely affected, but you still have the big component.
I mean,
and they're still both.
Average part is conserved, that would be great.
It's related to this question of renormalization.
Well, that's what you said.
And we haven't dealt with that yet.
Okay. Because if that's true, that's a big finding, because really we can then use this
we can't test
and scan them to the start.
We can't do these calculations with 1,000 times resolution.
I think that the trick here is use asymptotic scaling, you know, just study this in a small, accessible.
The trouble is you have to deal with the nonlinear terms very well.
I agree.
Well.
That's what we can do as well. So that will be and then we know with time, we test if the relation is standing the test of time when we have bigger computers. That's the only thing we can do.
Yeah.
And I think the other point would be all you've shown works for low Mach number. If you start getting in a Mach number close to 1, which is the case, for example, of convective layers closer to the surface,
No. If you look at the sun, you actually take a solar model. Do you know? Well, no. Well, even for the Aurigae, how much mass actually has a Mach number above 0.1?
But that's what's close to the boundary, and that's what you want.
0.1 only gives you an error here of 0.01.
I think what you said is important. Is you want to treat the boundary.
Yes.
That's where the weird things happen, you know.
Yes.
And so my point, I guess, is that
This is not focused at one of the key parts of physics of the boundary, namely the loss of the radiation. You know, actually, right. This particular calculation is for mine. Yeah. We're looking at what the turbulence does. We're trying to capture that.
Right.
Just a few comments, perhaps. Yeah. First, about the tunnel number, I know calculations which people do in Vienna. It's about the Institute of Mathematics. There's a guy there, Professor Mutzam.
I know it.
Kupka.
Okay. I know both of them.
Oh, very good. They use their own code, and if you use calculations, we'd say the Planck number of 0.1, 0.25, something like that, that's what most people do. And the most recent one, they managed to go down to 0.01. So
yeah. Is that Antares?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And they find a different structure if you have a higher precision.
I have no doubt that that's true, but I'm not sure. The question that I have, is that the relevant calculation to do? Because in the Antares code, when you put in the Prandtl number, you're making a built-in physical assumption about what happens at the smaller scale. Because the code does not resolve all the way down.
I know. Yeah.
And that's the crux of the issue. It's a nonlinear phenomena,
It's the only calculations I'm aware of which can resolve anything so-called diagonal simulations. It's in really bad arc correction. You do it, let's say, up to a Reynolds number, Rayleigh number of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7. Still far from what's happening in the star, but you get a little bit of an idea that now you really resolve all the scales down to the oscillation range. And unfortunately, I don't know what the effect of the Prandtl number is on that structure if you do these kind of simulations, which you can do with 2 days resources.
Well, I did not realize until I got in the midst of this that there's a built-in physics assumption about using Prandtl numbers and Reynolds numbers and Rayleigh numbers in turbulent flows. And it goes back to Reynolds. Reynolds pointed out that, in fact, in a turbulent flow, you should get mixing due to the turbulence at the smaller scales, which gives you a different effective number for, you know, Beckley, Prandtl. You just go down the list of the whole set. The problem is that if you're in a turbulent, non-linear regime, the nonlinearity resets the scale for the flow. And does it change it immediately? I don't know. I do know that for these calculations, it does change the scale for the Reynolds number.
Well, Rosenstein uses hyperviscosity for this accurate model.
Yeah, well, hyperviscosity does not have the proper cascade.
It's pure mathematical stuff.
Yeah. But it seems to me that they get basically the same results that we did.
And then there's this group by in Stanford, around Kosolice, Sasha Kosolice. They use different subgrid models, either Smagorinsky, modified Smagorinsky, and hyperviscosity.
Smagorinsky, I don't have, it was good at the time.
Yes.
But basically what happens if you put in subgrid models, you then lose some of the basic resolution that you have on your grid. That is, the advantage of using these non-monotonic solvers is that you can actually use all of your grid to follow down the turbulent cascade, which is why we did it. I mean, actually, that wasn't why we did it. We had that code. But having had that code, and then once we began to really explore what it meant, it was clear to us that that was a reasonable way to go. But it's not a solved problem. You know, don't presume I'm saying it's a solved problem. No. But I think it's a very interesting problem, and I think there's some subtleties that have not been appreciated by the community in general, particularly with regard to this point of the renormalization of the numbers in a turbulent regime. I think there's something going on.
I think it's could make a very good discussion to follow up when Pascal Dallot is coming here, because she's been working on this, not exactly this problem, but she had to been doing simulation of double diffusion stars, and she explored the dependency of thermal held mixing in particular case, which is the kind of double diffusion conduction you can have when you have like a, you know, salty hot water on top of cold fresh water. And you know, if you do the experiment, Prandtl number you find in the ocean, which it's order of unity, you got these long fingers. And that was the idea, which could happen maybe also in the stars, but it appears not. If you do the simulation and you go to you try to decrease the Prandtl number, of course you don't go to 10 to minus 6, we don't have to do that, but you go to 10 to minus 1 or 10 to minus 2 maybe. I don't know, maybe she got there. What she finds is that this structure doesn't exist. What you have like blobs that move and they get destroyed, which was the original picture of Kippenham, by the way. So, of course, then what they do, they do extrapolation of this load, they look at different points in their simulation, and they say, okay, yeah, well, what we say is that this is gonna be the trend, and therefore, at 10 to minus 6, we expect even less structure. And that but, makes the mixing very
But remember what the Prandtl number is. It's the ratio of the rate at which you're changing momentum to the rate at which you're moving heat. Right? So it's a ratio of diffusion scaling.
Yeah, it's Euler.
Right. And what happens that we know already from Kolmogorov is that for the momentum change, that is basically renormalized by the turbulent cascade. So the question is, okay, we know that that what happens. What effect does it have on the Prandtl number? It is, well, we tried to follow that up using renormalization theory and basically taking things out of the literature. It appears that, in fact, people had already come to the conclusion for the viscosity that, you know, it does renormalize things. Now the question is, okay, what about the heat transfer?
Right.
Well, if you've got a turbulent field, the heat transfer is also modified. So we need to think carefully. Sorry.
I think this point of normalization of the turbulence is pretty interesting. I don't fully understand this. I mean, I used to think that the non-linearity makes things very difficult to predict. If you change this ionic number, I mean, you can see, you know, if you take water and a gas, you can see straight away that the behavior is totally different. So finding a solution which is only dependent on a few parameters and heat hiding non-linearity in some term seems very difficult to do. That's why we don't have a theory for turbulence. I mean, that's the bottom line, I guess. So it's not anymore.
Much simpler. Have you taken care of it? Does this wonderful scheme, it sounds from what you've said, that we can now go to Ledoux, we get semi-convection automatically, are we going to get overshooting out of this miracle package too?
Yeah, that's what this one says.
Okay, so that's not just a semi-convection term applying in regions that are Ledoux stable with short shield.
This gives you overshooting. Yes. Semi-convection, there's another thing going on. That's the reason I brought this up.
What's your definition of semi-convection?
Well, semi-convection in stellar astronomy is motions in a stable region where you've got a convective gradient. A composition gradient. And it can be a lot of different things.
Everybody uses different definitions, fine.
Well, that was the one that was the one that I found.
Without buzzwords.
Yeah.
I can have a region that is stable by the Ledoux criterion, but is unstable by short shield. And
this is non-zero.
Thank you, yes. Well, it's not just non-zero, it's got a bigger sign. And when I, now what this is saying is that, lo and behold, that's not just going to be totally stable, there is going to be some mixing going in that. Okay, that's what I believe that was referred to. So this is going to tell me that, well, first of all, you didn't actually say what the Richardson, is there a critical Richardson number above which we do something?
Experimentally, it's about 1/4.
And is, at that point, are we going to turn on some kind of mixing in our 1D model?
Acoustic flux.
Yeah.
Penetrates. So what you're doing when you do semi-convection, you put things close to a marginal boundary. What convection does is shake the whole thing. So there is a built-in set of perturbations. And for example, the semi-convection zone in massive stars, where you've got a convective core and semi-convection lines above it. And this happens on a faster time scale than the UNO mechanism.
Is that a yes or a no?
That is, it's an unfinished question. There's more okay. physics that needs to be looked okay. at. And this is actually a pretty good audience to think about that, because you guys know about waves. And what this is saying is that I'm jiggling this thing, and I can give you an amplitude.
But as
this is a nonlinear system, so it sets an amplitude.
But as interior models, we want to know, what do we do to our interior models to reflect this? How much do we mix? Do we mix? How far do we mix?
Well, that's one.
I'll keep asking him rude questions like that
Well, this sounds like the beginning of a dialogue rather than You might want to reserve Fridays at the
Just seeing this picture here, the acoustic waves are generating the whole convection zone. Acoustic waves are generated in the whole convection zone, not only in the boundaries.
Right.
Because of the incompressibility. The reason why Mixing doesn't include it is that you assume the so-called Busnes approximation.
Right.
Which implicitly is one of the big assumptions of Busnes approximation is incompressibility, so the divergence of the velocity field disappears.
That's right.
And it is exactly that very reason why, for instance, in the sun, the oscillations are excited. And that, although the bulk of the excitation indeed takes place very close to the surface, about 50 to 150 kilometers.
In the super adiabatic region.
That's right.
And that's where
some of it also takes place rather deeper into the sun.
Right, because
you're particularly low frequency models.
Yes. And that's what you would expect. I mean, if you look at these equations, they tell you that. Because at the surface, the Bach numbers are getting high, you're beginning to get compressibility happening. And in the deep layer, all of the luminosity, essentially, is being carried by convection. And that means that you've got buoyant acceleration. And if you've got buoyant acceleration, you build up these modes of overturn, and they interact with the boundaries. So, you know, that's part of it too. And there, you know, there are more things that are falling out of this. But the fact that we've written down physics equations and we're trying to put the physics equations into a form so we can reproduce one set or several very similar sets of calculations is giving us a lot of insight into how the equations work. Is it solving the problem? I have no idea. But it certainly is fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.